Good morning. I'd like to call to order today's meeting of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Education for Wednesday, June 14th, 2017. Colleagues, we are going to follow the agenda as you see it before us. We have two public hearings, and a public hearing and a work session. And we are going to start at the top with Senate Bill 20A. So I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 20A and call up, and call on Mr. Wilson from LFO first.
Madam Chair, I think we'll let Ms. Hunt from the department go through this bill. It is a governor's bill or a department bill. This basically removes references to the old federal bill, No Child Left Behind, replaces it with the ESSA references to bring us into sync with the federal law. The fiscal impact on this bill, which is indeterminate, relates around foster care, transportation issues, and I think you'll address that also.
Okay. Thank you. Great. Co-Chair Smith Warner, members of the committee, good morning. As Mr. Wilson talked about, this is a technical fix bill. You've heard Dr. Knorr over the course of months talk about ESSA on and off. So this was the bill to bring Oregon's law into compliance with ESSA. So I'm going to talk about basically two areas today. The first one is around the modified diploma. Under ESSA, basically ESSA says for the states to have two kinds of diplomas, kind of the diploma that gets you everything in life and the diploma that's for as an alternative. In Oregon, we have our regular diploma, our modified, and our extended diploma. The modified diploma is signifies a high level of achievement by children. It has the same number of credits. And a couple of years ago, we successfully argued to the federal government that it was equivalent to a diploma in Oregon. And in that way, kids that receive modified diplomas receive federal financial aid, for example, for higher ed. And so what this bill does is it basically, throughout Oregon law, treats the modified diploma like a diploma. So, for example, for a licensing board who previously required a diploma to get the license, a modified diploma would qualify for that, would be an example. So that's change number one. Change number two is around foster kids. In Oregon, a few years ago, we clarified the residency of a foster child. So in Oregon law, what it says is that normally residency is where your parents or your person and parental relationship lives. For foster kids, though, when they're placed in like another district, what we said that their residency was going to be in that district. And we did that for very good reasons. What federal law, what ESSA does is it flips that. And what it says is that the residency of the child stays where the parent was, where that child was before foster placement. Under both, though, it allows an exception if a judge rules that the child should go to the other district. So systemically, we don't think that this is going to make a difference. For some individual kids, it will. And we worked on this section of the bill with the Youth Rights and Justice Organization, and frankly, they made it better. And I know they've submitted testimony in favor of the bill that you can review. And then, as Mr. Wilson said, as we were working through this, the steps in the process, one of the things that we did was we've been in the process of entering into an interagency agreement with the Department of Human Services for the transportation of foster kids who are kind of placed outside of a district and need to be transported back to that district for transportation. And through that interagency agreement, Department of Human Services will be transferring federal funds to the Department of Ed, and that way we can use those federal funds in conjunction with the state school funds, so a school district that provides transportation to the foster kids will have 100% reimbursement. So we think this will serve to have the districts transport more of the kids in a safer manner. And it also frees up, my understanding, some dollars, federal dollars, on the DHS side of the equation because we're using state school fund dollars. This does not have a big impact on the state school fund, and you'll see that in the revenue impact statement and the fiscal statement. But we're very happy to, partner with DHS and do this so that more kids essentially get to school. And with that, I'm open for questions.
Thank you. Colleagues, Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Mrs. Hunt, thank you for your testimony. I agree that it doesn't seem like a big deal. I have two quick questions. Does the foster child have an input? You said the judge can But does he or she get to submit a?
Yeah. Chair Smith Warner, Representative Wisnett, I believe it depends on the age of the child. And I'm not a foster law kind of expert, and I can check back, but I believe it's generally on the age of the child. And so the situation that we're talking about would be, you know, the child's going to school in District A, this is where their parents live, and they're placed maybe with a grandparent or a foster parent. And then the judge determines that, you know, really the best placement for school purposes is over here and not here. And that happens today, you know, and so I think the judge receives input from a variety of sources. The kid would be one of them, but there'd be other sources.
Thank you.
Follow up?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. There's so many issues in the Department of Education, but you're saying it's not going to be a big impact. We need to address this transportation grant. That transportation grant, the way we do that is not right. I hope the senator agrees with me. It's been out there. You get 70% of what you expend. We have a situation. We have a homeless facility in Bend, and children live in all three school districts. And the school actually picks them up there and takes them. They're the first on and first off, so there's no possibility of bullying or something like that. But we really need to address, hope in the future, the Department of Education will look at this transportation grant and clear that up. Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Senator Roblin.
Yeah, along that line, I think this new arrangement is the best that I could hope for right now, especially getting some money from the federal government to transport kids. One of the biggest problems that these foster kids have is having to move school to school to school to school. And if you can keep them in the same school longer, it's much better for them and everybody else. And having now a way to transport them back to their school, if it's not too far, just makes sense. And we should have been able to figure out a way to do that, but I'm pleased you did it. So.
Yeah. Thank you, Senator Roblin. Yes, both Oregon law and federal law had the same intention. We just approached it from two different ends.
Yep.
Yeah.
Anyone else?
Madam Chair, just in terms of the fiscal, it is our intention to recommend that we add, I think, roughly between $300,000 and $500,000 of other funds limitation to take care of the fund transfer between the two agencies. And we will likely also recommend a budget note to make sure they come back and show how it's working, as well as to see if there's some potential for matching some federal funds on the DHS side from the use of the state school fund dollars.
Okay. Anyone else? If not, thank you.
Thank you,
Cindy. And I'd like to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 20. And I would like to open a public hearing on House Bill 3355 and start with Mr. Wilson and also acknowledge.
You want to do the vision screen?
Wasn't that what
no,
that?
That's
oh, sorry.
The other bill.
I'd like to close a public hearing on House Bill 3355 and go to the correct sheet. And open a hearing on Senate Bill 187. And therefore, it is that's why Mr. Wilson panicked, because he didn't have any information about that particular bill.
Madam Chair, a little slower than I used to be. Senate Bill 187 establishes the Vision Health account and directs the Department of Education to reimburse an education provider for any costs associated with student vision screenings. The bill appropriates $3 million general fund to the Department of Education for the purpose of administering grants reimbursed from the vision screenings. ODE anticipates having a fiscal impact related to one position for the to administer the grants. And the current language in the bill does not permit ODE to be reimbursed for these administrative costs. Therefore, they'll probably need to be... I had to run here. I'm sorry. there will probably need to be either an additional appropriation for the administrative costs or some amending language to allow the department to reimburse from the vision screening account for administrative costs.
By the schools? Reimburse the schools
or
reimburse themselves?
Department of Education.
Okay. Okay. And Senator Manning, I would like to acknowledge Senator Manning has joined us. Would you like to testify from the dais to start us off? And we right now have four people signed up to testify. We'll go through those, and then if there's anyone else, we'll give you that opportunity. But I'd like to welcome Senator Manning to our committee.
Madam Co-Chair, thank you so very much, members of the committee. Indeed, it is a pleasure to be sitting here before you today. For the record, my name is James Ivory Manning, Jr. I'm a senator from Senate District 7, which is Eugene and Junction City. I am here today in support of this bill. I did testimony on this bill along with Representative Farish, and it was Senator Devlin when the bill was in the Senate. This is this bill. I know you have a lot of people that's lined up to do testimony, so I'll be very brief. But I did want to kind of share a little bit of my feelings why this bill is so important. I remember as a child growing up, I had problems, and I thought it was a couldn't understand why I was not able to catch up with the other students from my position in the classroom. I had no idea anything about wearing glasses or the need for glasses. Most kids don't think about things like that. Until one day, I was fortunate enough to get a vision screening, and it was determined that with glasses, I could see the board, which means that I understood what I was seeing, and I could do my work. This is such a critical part as we try to mend the gap in the loss in our students in the education system. Some of our students are missing out because simply they can't see the board. Sometimes it's so easy for minor things to help a child to excel in school. There was a study that was done in St. Louis regarding the dropout rates, and it was determined that a small thing as access to a washer and dryer made the difference between a child going to school. When we start looking at vision, this is a very critical part that we can do, and we have to do a much better job. It helps when a kid can see what they're doing, they're more engaged to continue on. So I urge you, and again, I know that you have a lot of people that's going to be testifying, so I don't want to hold up this, but I just wanted to come here and say this bill is really important, and it's important to me. And we have educators up here, and I look around and I see a lot of, the board and the committee wearing glasses too. So I think that you kind of get the message. and co-chair, Senator Monroe also has glasses. So I urge your I vote on this and send it to the full Ways and Means so that we can vote on this and get this thing done. Subject to any of your questions, that's all I have. And thank you so much for this opportunity.
Thank you, Senator. Any questions for our colleague?
Yeah.
Senator, Mr. Co-chair.
Yeah, Senator Manning, I support this bill and absolutely agree with everything you said. And as soon as the powers above us give us the go-ahead to work it, we will move it. Right today, we're only having a public hearing.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, and I will be waiting at the full Ways and Means in order to move, along with Representative Wisden,
yeah,
so we can get this thing done. Madam Co-Chair, thank you.
Thank you for coming. Okay, I have five people right now signed up, so I'm just going to call up the first three. Doug Thompson, Brenda Anderson, and Karen Tarmichael, if you want to come up. And please start your testimony with your name so we have that for the record. And we only have an hour. We have an early floor session today, so if you could limit yourself to about 2 or 3 minutes, that would be great. Okay. And thank you all for being here. And go ahead and start whoever is so moved.
Chair Smith-Warner, Chair Monroe, and members of the committee, my name is Doug Thompson. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Lions Sight and Hearing Foundation. In being respectful of your time, we could have signed up many more people to testify today.
I see many yellow vests in the audience.
So thank you again for the opportunity to speak to Senate Bill 187. This is something that is near and dear to our hearts and has been for many, many years. So I'll try to really just capsulize really why it is that we're here. The Oregon Lions Sight and Hearing Foundation has many programs that help Oregonians in need from a sight and hearing standpoint, hearing aids, hearing exams, vision surgery, eye exams, eyeglasses. Our flagship program, though, is going into the schools and helping identify Oregon school children that could be performing better academically, that could have higher self-esteem if they simply had a vision issue detected. Senate Bill 187 will play a significant role in helping high school graduation rate because more and more kids will be able to succeed academically. In terms of, again, why we are here, this is not a new program in our minds, and I hope that it's not in yours either. It was in 2011 that the state of Oregon and the Department of Education invited the Oregon Lion Sight and Hearing Foundation to participate in a pilot vision screening project. At that time, we were screening approximately 25,000 Oregon students a year and felt pretty good about doing that. However, the pilot project gave us an opportunity to test our methodology and to see that there was a better way of doing it. With state-of-the-art technology, we're very unique here in Oregon in that we have the largest vision screening program in the country, screening accurately and efficiently. School nurses and teachers absolutely love this program because kids are out of the classroom for a very short period of time, and they're being detected in a very accurate fashion using this technology. That pilot project inspired us to raise a bunch of money so we could purchase this type of equipment, so we could expand our program. And within a couple of years, we doubled the number of students that we were screening. And then in 2013, House Bill 3000 passed, which then created a mandate for all children by age 7 to have a vision screening. And schools came out of the woodwork to request our services to come in and help families meet that mandate. So we went from screening about 50,000 kids a year to now, currently we're screening about almost 180,000 Oregon students per year. The challenge for us is that we used to live within our fundraising limitations and a certain budget for this program. But because we've tried to work hand-in-hand with the state and help families meet this mandate, we have had board approval, and some members in the room here are members of our board. In fact, our board treasurer is in here with fiscal statements, audited financials from the last couple of years that illustrate that we've been spending operating reserves for the last couple of years to keep up with the demand. And I regret to say that if Senate Bill 187 does not pass, our approved budget for July through next June does not include the ability to screen 180,000 students. Without state funding, we will have to roll back the number of kids that we screen to somewhere in the neighborhood of 35 to 50,000 kids a year. Without funding from the state, there will probably be at least 40 to 50,000 kids a year that would have been detected with a vision issue that will not have that issue detected. So unlike Senator Manning that then found out that he needed glasses, we're going to have too many kids. They're going to slip through the cracks and probably contribute to that poor high school graduation rate that we have. So I thank you from the bottom of my heart for the opportunity to be here today, for your support for Senate Bill 187, and for your support for the vision health of Oregon school children.
Thank you very much. Go ahead.
Thank you. Co-Chairs Monroe, Smith-Morner, members of the committee. I am Brenda Anderson, the Associate Director of the Oregon Lion Sight and Hearing Foundation. For the past 16 years, my work with the Lions Foundation has focused entirely on the operations of our sight and hearing saving programs, the largest of which is our mobile health screening program going into schools and serving children. I'm going to skip ahead through some of what Doug touched on with the pilot project, but to go back to it real quick, that pilot project allowed our foundation to evaluate its processes from delivery model from top to bottom, where before we had used semi-trucks that had been set up in the trailer portion as a clinic and we would go out to schools. We had capped out at about 150 students per day providing a screening process, and when Doug mentioned the 25,000 that we were able to screen on average on an annual basis, that represented about 7% of the total student population in K through 8 at that time. Right now, as Doug mentioned, we were screening about 180,000 students in that same population, grades K through 8. Right now, per a report from the Department of Education last year, there are 394,000, or just about 400,000 students in those grade ranges. That does represent at a referral rate that we have found using our digital and objective devices that are also based and use a cloud, HIPAA and FERPA secure data collection and storage options so that we can keep student data secure. We're able to provide those results back. We're able to take this information, we're able to provide those screenings and refer approximately 40 to 60,000 students a year of those 400,000 if we were able to do that. That represents a huge volume of students who need that kind of vision support. The scope of work as defined by the Department of Education report based on the House Bill 3000 that the state faces, and I've updated those numbers, are 400,000 students in grades K through 8 enrolled in 212 districts in approximately 1,200 schools across the state. Currently, with our revamped expanded program, we coordinate about 650 events with that 180,000 students, about 45% of those total kids. Our foundation has exhausted our operational funding opportunities, and our budget next year does reduce our program impact in half, if not further. We cannot continue to sustain this ongoing program, and schools rely on our rapid digital technology. I will conclude with the most vital number of all is that 10%, that referral rate. Those are the kids that we need to get in for that exam in order to find out what's going on in order to prevent blindness and sight loss. Thank you.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for your time this morning. My name is Karen Tarmichael. I live and work in the city of Newburgh along with my husband and my two daughters. I'm here today to talk to you specifically about one child who happens to be my child. Paige is not able to join us today. She's in the seventh grade, and the choir is singing for the high school graduates. And she wanted to be here today because this is something she enjoys talking about, but choir won out, so my apologies. Paige Tarmichael is turning 13. She's a seventh grader at C.S. Lewis School. She is a two-time junior state champion in Taekwondo. She's been in three musicals. She learned two instruments this year. She hunts, she fishes, she kayaks. She's rebuilding a Dodge Dart Swinger with her father in the garage on Sundays. She volunteers, she reads voraciously, she draws, she loves music. Sounds like your typical middle schooler. Except she almost wasn't any of these things. 2 years ago, she was a fifth grader who was getting weekly reports about not being on task, not being focused, not sitting at her desk, not having her eyes on her papers. She was struggling to keep her teachers happy. She was doing hours of homework at home, and I mean 10 o'clock at night, hours. She had messy handwriting. She was behind. And this had started at third grade, fourth grade. Fall of fifth grade, the Lions came in with this. In 9 seconds, they had a report to tell me that my daughter can't see. And when I say she can't see, her left eye is a +3, her right eye is a +2. Try reading what's in front of you without your glasses. That's how she learned to read and write. And she didn't know she was different from the other kids. That's the point that comes out of this. This young lady got retested by a pediatric eye doctor who said that camera was more accurate than any eye test she'd ever had at the pediatrician's. Now, 2 years later, she is thriving. She is into anything she can get her hands on. And that is the point that I want you to understand. The day she walked out of the office with her glasses, she looked up at the trees that were changing color and said, oh, each leaf isn't the same color. It just about dropped me to my knees. How did we miss it? How? She'd never been uninsured, never missed a pediatric appointment, never missed school except for illness. She was in every way a blessed child. Health insurance, good food, educated family, all the things we think will catch these things, we missed it. We all didn't see it. She played softball and hit the ball regularly. I don't know what she was swinging at. And, you know, so how did we miss it? She didn't know she didn't see like the other kids. She had no way to put that into context. So these kids don't know how to ask for help. But had this camera not come into her classroom, it's possible the next year she would have given up. That would have been the year she quit, decided to just be the clown in the classroom or the kid who barely got C's. We would have lost all the gifts that this very vivacious child has. And that's what this Senate bill is so important. That's what everybody needs to understand, that if we missed a kid like Paige, we are missing thousands of children. And they don't even know they're not seeing. And they're probably giving up long before she did. I don't know how tough she must be, because to get to the age of 10, 11 and not quit, I know adults that can't do that. You've got kids who have parents who don't have the resources my family did, don't know that their child can't see, don't even know themselves they can't see. This program needs to be funded, and I know our education system has a great deal on its plate, and I understand you have dollars to spend in very careful ways. We have things to address. But for every dollar you spend, it's a wasted tool if the child can't see, hear, write, they won't be able to use what you're providing, and they'll continue to fall through the cracks.
Thank you.
So I really thank you for considering it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Parrish.
The question for Doug, or, you know, because of this technology, because this was a little more expensive when we started this 7 years ago, but what are you down to now on a price per screening per child?
Representative Parrish, that's a great question, and thank you for asking it, because I failed to mention that. At the time that we had the opportunity to participate with that pilot vision screening, our average cost was around $10 or so per student for screening. It's now all the way down to about $3.20. Mm-hmm. So we're very, very pleased with the efficiency and the cost effectiveness of this model of how we're screening.
And the follow-up would be, comparatively, if you were getting a vision screening out in at the doctor,
the market value costs for such a screening is approximately $28.
Thank you. Anyone else? Okay, thank you all very much. I'd like to call up the last two folks for their, if they could briefly add to any testimony, if there's anything you feel hasn't been shared. Brad King and Misty Martin Zimmerman.
Good morning, Co-Chairs Monroe and Smith Warner, members of the committee. My name is Brad King, B-R-A-D-K-I-N-G. I'm a Lion from Tualatin and an event manager for the Oregon Lions Sight and Hearing Foundation's Mobile Health Screening Program. I retired from local law enforcement about 6 years ago, and I've worked in the Mobile Health Screening Program for just over 5 years. I'm a lucky lion that gets to go almost every day and manage vision screening for students all over Oregon, helping to consistently identify just over 10% of those students who need more vision assistance, like an exam and eyeglasses or medical optical assistance. There are tremendous resources in Oregon for students to get those exams and glasses or medical optical treatment, but those students must be identified first, and that happens at school-based vision screenings. As you heard, this year, our organization helped do vision screening for almost 180,000 school students in Oregon, with a referral rate of just over 10%, or over 18,000 families who found out that their child needed to go to the eye doctor, who would likely not have known that without that screening. The partners in these school screenings, teachers, principals, school secretaries, administrators, and especially school nurses, appreciate, support, and endorse this program. It takes an untenable amount of work off the shoulders of overburdened and scarce school nurses and provides an equitable, efficient, and effective vision screening for all students. As a respected school nurse says, quote, "Why can't Johnny read well? Johnny cannot read well because he cannot see. If 80% of learning is visual, we're denying these children access to appropriate education. Ensuring that a child has needed glasses may also reduce the cost of providing intensive interventions," unquote. Committee members, a $3.20 vision screening is a dollar's worth of prevention as opposed to thousands in intervention, support, and other costs that fail to, quote, cure, unquote, the lifetime of problems as an undereducated adult in Oregon. Let's not fail these children. As I said, we screen school children's vision all over Oregon, in inner cities, big towns, suburbs, small communities, and remote rural areas, all over Oregon. Representative Smith, Warner, and Hernandez, we screen children in large cities like Portland, Salem, and Eugene. Senator Monroe, we screen children in your district, the North Clackamas School District.
Yep.
Senator Roblin, we screen children at schools in virtually every town in your district between Tillamook and Coos Bay. Senator Thompson, we screen children at all the public schools and some private schools in your district in Clackamas and Hood River County, with lions from Sandy and all over Hood River County. My autumn vacation takes place in Hood River County.
Great.
Representative Lively, with a number of Springfield and Eugene area lions, we screen children at all the elementary and middle schools in your district. Representative Parrish, you know quite well that we screen all the public and some private schools in your district. And Representative Wisnett, with the Lions of Central Oregon, the hardworking Lions of Central Oregon, we screen school children at public schools in your district in Redmond and the Bend Lapine School District. Thank you for your time. Thank you for your consideration. I can't stress how important this is.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Good morning. My name is Misty Martin Zimmerman, and I wasn't sure if I was going to make it today, so I don't have a grand speech, and I don't have all these great notes, but what I do want to tell you is a little bit about my daughter's story. So I have three amazing children, three under seven, so as you can imagine, life is crazy. I have a beautiful middle daughter with the biggest blue eyes that you've ever seen in your whole entire life. This last year, I came home to a note on the counter to the parents of Quinn Zimmerman. And as I'm guessing most of you probably have had children in the past, you always assume the worst intent. Oh God, what did my daughter do at school today? I opened it up only to find out that she had failed her vision exam. And I'm like, how could she fail her vision exam? She's a kindergartner. She's reading at a kindergartner level. She's been to all of her, you know, school testing. She's had her pediatric visits. Everything that you would need to do as a responsible parent. How did I fail her? So I immediately called and made a vision appointment with her. And I showed up and the doctor looked at her and he said, how has she been functioning for her life? So some of you up here have glasses and know, my daughter's left eye was 7.65. So as you can imagine, he said, how did it not turn in? That's usually one of the biggest signs for a lazy eye. He said, if this would have continued, she probably would have lost almost all sight in her left eye. Not to mention her right eye was 3. So this poor girl has never been able to see from the moment she was born. So we went through all the steps. He gave her the depth perception book, and he said she can't see depth. She can't do and function as a normal individual. Like, this poor child has never been able to see. So with intervention and through the help of patching along with her now glasses, she now has a new world. Every single day she wakes up and she's like, that's what that looks like. I mean, I can't even imagine looking through the eyes of, you know, a child like that, especially when they're almost nearly blind. And I'm happy to report through that and everything that we've been doing, her left eye has improved to 5.5. because now her right eye can relax. So I can't tell you guys how important this is, because being that she was in kindergarten, she still has so much of her life now where she's not going to fall behind. She is the cutest dang thing with those glasses on. Like, she, everybody wants to be like her now, you know? And I want to say that had this not had been done in her school, that I don't know where she would have fallen and how far she would have fallen behind. So I want to thank you guys for hearing my story and, you know, just really looking into the new year. And if you guys have even an ounce of dollars to spend towards this, it really is so important. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. Any questions?
Yeah, Co-Chair.
Mr. Co-Chair.
That was compelling testimony as a former teacher for a long time. Having dealt with students, some of whom had serious vision problems, it can make all the difference in the world. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Parrish.
So I just want to comment overall on the bill. I'm a sponsor on the bill. I didn't get up with Senator Manning, and I've sponsored every one of these bills that have come forward. I guess if there was a pork project that I want to spend money on, it would be this as a legislator. We had the same experience. Full coverage for entire life for a child who, you know, bedazzled people on the soccer field and was a stellar academic student, and actually an audiology screening said that he was having a hearing problem. Pediatrician said, well, let's also get him into a vision. He only had sand in his ears. We scraped that out, solved that problem. He gets to the doctor and he's almost blind in one eye, and we didn't catch it until he was already 8. And really, it was the impetus for us joining our local Lions Club. So if you had a chance to go out last month and have burgers on the front steps, that was our Westland Club who was out there doing that. We flip a lot of hamburgers, colleagues, to fund this and keep their reserves going, but that's, there's only so many hamburgers you can sell. And so we've been Lions Club members since Mark came home from Iraq, because that was the one service club that he said, you know, when I get home and I'm done deploying, I want to be involved in something, and this is the club where I want to be. And so our kids spend a lot of time volunteering for this organization. You know, it not only just does, our Lions Clubs are not only doing this in our community, we're funding college scholarships, we're trying to do a lot of other things in our district, but, you know, they are tapped out. As tapped out as they're going to get in the bigger overall picture. And the other piece of this is that our service organizations are losing membership. Millennials and Gen X people don't necessarily want to join a service organization. And so we've had a lot of members actually just die outright, and we're having a hard time replacing them in our community with people who are willing to serve. And so at this point, you know, I think this really is a rubber meets the road decision for the legislature. Do we want to continue to invest in this work when we know that there's a cost savings and when we know that there are kids who are we're finding? And so, you know, this, like I said, this is my pork project ask, is that we fund this as part of the school day for children. It's really important.
Thank you. Anyone else?
Thank you both for testifying.
Thank you.
With that, is there anyone else who did not get onto the sign-up sheet that by accident? Okay. Thank you all for being here, and I'd like to close the hearing on Senate Bill 187 and ask that we stand in recess for a few moments, please,
can
colleagues.
Could we possibly take...
I like to bang all the time.
Well, look, yes.
Good morning. I'd like to reconvene today's meeting of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Education and move on to the next item on our agenda, which is to open a public hearing on House Bill 3355. Do I have to open them both together? I don't, do I? I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 3355 and call up Representative Kennemer, please. Thank you for your patience.
Madam Chair, for the record, Bill Kennemer, State Representative, District 39. Thank you and the committee for a few minutes to talk about House Bill 3355, an important bill from my perspective. I go back a few years, in fact, practice for about 30 years, and I really think this bill has an important role to play in the changing face of the way we treat the mentally ill and people who are having difficulties. And I think it can be another major asset in our effort to be a leader in healthcare reform in America. Couple of things about this. I served in the Senate back in the 80s and 90s, and
yes, we did.
Yes, we did, as a matter of fact. And, you know, it was an interesting thing. One of the things that we did is we started talking about, and we passed a law to require the integration of mental and medical health, or medical care, I should say. And in 2009, when I returned to the House, we had another bill calling, because we found that that integration wasn't getting very far. We called for parity because we realized that these two work hand in hand, and that we needed to have parity of behavioral and physical health. I think Oregon has a tradition of being an innovator and a leader in health care. You know, we've pushed nurse practitioners, and we've seen them evolve, and we have mental health nurse practitioners. We have PAs, physician assistants. Frankly, we've even crossed some lines with naturopaths and let them have a lot more prescriptive privilege. And we've begun to realize that turf wars don't make things better. They make things worse. Another problem that we're facing right at the moment is that we have a shortage of mental health medical providers, particularly in non-urban areas. And also another piece of that is the expense of that. And so I think it's time to get off of some of these guild wars. We've been seeing it across the nation. In 2002, New Mexico passed a bill similar to this. In 2006, the U.S. Public Health under the Indian Health Services created a program in 2006. Louisiana passed a law in 2004, Illinois in 2014, Iowa in 2016, Idaho in 2017. I think it's time for the innovative leadership of Oregon to do a similar thing. A couple of things about background. There's been some question about the ability of psychologists to do some of this work. First of all, in order to become a psychologist, you have to have a bachelor's degree to even get admitted to graduate school, and typically a bachelor's degree with honors, frankly. And then you have a 5 or 6 year course, including internships in medical settings. 5 to 6 years, mine was a 6 year program, and I managed to get it done in 7. It's a long program. And under this bill, you would have another 2 to 3 years of additional training, because certainly there is more to learn. Certainly I did not graduate as an expert, although I did work in clinical settings, supervised at USC by a psychiatrist, and worked in directly evaluating patients and making recommendations that the psychiatrist signed off on. I think... another thing that I would add as I wrap this up is I practiced for over 30 years in Oregon. And one of the things that I came is in the 70s, psychology was kind of anti-medicine because we thought people were being over-medicated. And In the course of my treatment, I began to find there was a need for some balance in this. And I found that it was easy to medicate, and a lot of times physicians did that as a way to just get people off their backs. But the other side of that is those have harmful side effects. And the other thing I found is that as people progressed, when they were in crisis, medication was often very essential, although reactions to it varied so much that a lot of times they needed to change their medicine. And then I found as they made progress, often quickly, they needed variations in their dosage levels. And I think I would have been, I think I was successful as a therapist, but I think I would have been much more successful had I been able to adjust their medicines, because frankly, there was very little relationship with the psychiatric community and the physician community, frankly, and I hesitate to say this, but we're not always on top of these matters. And, you know, 3 months of specialization in psychiatric medicine was often not enough. With that, I urge your support. I think there are some others who will add to it, and I appreciate your taking time to look at this bill. And, of course, if you have a question, I'd be delighted.
Thank you, colleagues. Mr. Co-Chair.
Well, Madam Co-Chair, my friend Bill Kennemer, if he has run out of razor blades, I have some that I'm not using anymore.
Well, thank you for that comment. I have been saying things are getting a bit hairy around here.
Dun-dun-dunch. Okay.
Thank
With
you.
That, thank you so much. Okay, next I would like to call up Dr. Robin Hendinon. Perhaps? Dr. Paul Geiger and Dr. Diane Solomon.
Henderson?
Yeah. All right. I was looking hard for that S in there and couldn't see it, so I'm going to have to take your word for it.
It's that handwriting.
You know, doctors, handwriting.
Yeah.
I'm not casting any aspersions, but okay.
Madam Co-Chair, Smith Warner and Co-Chair Senator Monroe. For the record, my name is Robin Henderson. I am a licensed psychologist by training. I am also the chief executive of behavioral health for Providence Health System here in Oregon. Sorry, let me adjust the mic so it's not right in my eyesight. I've been with them for about a year. I'm a proud constituent of Representative Parrish. Prior to that, I spent 14 years in Central Oregon as a proud constituent of Representative Wisnett, serving with St. Charles Health System. And by background and training, I've worked in mental health my entire career. I've been licensed for 20 years now, frankly, as a psychologist. And I've worked primarily in acute and residential settings throughout my career with some of the sickest children, adults, and seniors that we see. I am here to talk with you in support of House Bill 3355. I want to share a little bit of the history of the bill, and I want to walk the bill with you so that you understand clearly what it is that we're asking.
And Dr. Henderson,
and I'll do it very quickly.
I was going to say thank you.
I'm going to do it real quickly.
Yeah,
you got it.
Early session this
morning.
So back
in 2007, I was on the interim committee, chaired at that time by the new freshman legislator, Tina Kotek, that first brought together psychologists and psychiatrists to talk about how we could move this bill forward. In 2010, we had an interim session in between the legislative sessions of 2009 and 2010, where we brought in the Center for Dispute Resolution and we mediated between the Oregon Psychological Association and the Oregon Psychiatric Association to come up with the educational requirements you see here today. We had a consensus agreement and a bill in 2010 that was subsequently vetoed. Fast forward 7 years later, we bring you House Bill 3355. The shortage of psychiatric providers in Oregon has not changed. We are now in even more dire need of folks who can put all hands on deck to help cover this important population. The bill right now requires a license, as Representative Kennemer said, a license in psychology to be able to practice as a psychologist, to have completed residency and be licensed in Oregon, and an additional 2 to 3 years of postdoctoral certification as outlined in the bill that was agreed to in 2010. Additionally, the bill now moves the Oversight Committee under the Oregon Board of Psychologist Examiners, along with creating a subcommittee that now has a majority of physician members overseeing the practice. That is a change from the bill that was vetoed. We feel that strengthens the bill to have majority physician oversight. We also now require, and this is the final change, we require that psychologists who are going to practice in this fashion practice in collaboration with physicians in a medical setting. That is a huge difference from what we presented in 2010. I am a big fan and supporter of collaborative teams, and I think Dr. Geiger will address that more. But those are the primary aspects of the bill before you today and the changes from what you saw in 2010. I want to lastly offer my thanks to the Oregon Nurses Association for their support in welcoming us to the care team and being willing to support psychologists prescribing and give a hand up in that effort. Right now in Oregon, according to the Oregon Health Authority, a little less than half of adults and a little more than a third of children are not receiving care, that they need. We need all hands on deck, and that's what Oregon psychologists are here for you today. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Dr. Geiger?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Geiger. I'm a board-certified psychiatrist working in Portland. I'm the regional medical director of Behavioral Health Providence. Over a decade experience doing acute care and consultative psychiatry, I'm here to testify in support of Bill 3355. The shortage of the workforce is not a mystery. I think it's well understood. Its demographics suggest it's going to get worse, with the average age of the psychiatrist in the U.S. being 56. We're anticipating that the current shortage, which is now severe, will only worsen. We've tried to be creative in how do we spread what little resource we have by using creative models, collaborative care models, telepsychiatry, short-term consultative models. And even with that effort, we've really struggled to fill positions. The workforce is just not there. And I'm very concerned without additional help that that problem will only get worse. You know, as a physician who trained in both internal medicine and psychiatry, I understand that there are concerns around whether this bill is safe. You're going to have non-medical providers prescribing medications. People are uncomfortable with that. I just comment on that. If you look at psychiatric practice as it's done in and I'm most familiar with the Portland area, there already is, to some degree, a split between the care that's given on the psychiatric end and the care that's given on the medical end. For example, if you're admitted to a hospital as a patient, a psychiatric patient in the Portland area, psychiatrists may admit you to the hospital. Another clinician does your physical exam. This is true at Portland Hospitals, Unity, the big new thing, Cedar Hills Hospital. A medical provider, ER physician, internist, adult nurse practitioner, does the physical exam. Why is that so? Well, psychiatrists who have focused most of their training on the mental aspect of care over time express discomfort in having that responsibility and have kind of stepped away from that role. So that's the facts of how care is delivered in the Portland area, and I think it represents, a truism around comfort and expertise in that area. So when you look at this bill, you have psychologists who are well-trained professionals, experts in patient-client-clinician relationship, boundaries, making a diagnosis, which is the most important part of treatment, expert in that. With the additional training, I feel confident that this plan will provide for the addition of an excellent member of a care team working in concert with the medical setting, and it's a much-needed resource. So thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Dr. Solomon.
Co-chairs Monroe, Smith, Warner, and members of the committee, I am Diane Solomon. I have a PhD in nursing. I am a psychiatric nurse practitioner representing ONA. I also, thanks to my colleague here, David Pollack, teach medical students at OHSU. I believe mental health access for all is essential in this state, particularly among marginalized populations and those in rural and remote areas. In Oregon, we definitely have a mental health crisis. We're one of the few states with the dubious distinction of the most citizens with mental health issues, and the least access to mental health care. While the Health Resources and Services Administration designates any area with less than one psychiatrist per 30,000 individuals a mental health professional shortage area, in Oregon that comprises basically the entire state outside of Portland and Eugene. I've personally had patients travel from Roseburg, Hood River, and beyond to be seen simply because there are no mental health prescribers anywhere in their vicinity. Meanwhile, as we've heard, the pool of psychiatrists is diminishing, particularly those working in remote and rural areas and with marginalized population. And evidence proves that those who are marginalized often suffer the greatest impact due to social determinants of health, trauma, and abuse. This makes them even more vulnerable to all mental health issues, particularly PTSD, anxiety, and depression. And we cannot continue to fail these Oregonians. We must create a safety net and a civil society that cares for all. Equity lens. House Bill 3355 can go far to accomplish this by ensuring adequate training and supervision of psychologists as prescribers. There are not enough prescribers, psychiatrists, or psychiatric nurse practitioners working especially with marginalized or rural populations to supervise, and we're all needed to supervise psychologists and help ameliorate the crisis. Nurse practitioners are an evidence-based solution. We garner higher patient satisfaction scores than physicians and achieve outcomes that are equal to or better than our physician peers, with all due respect. Our patient-centered care results in higher patient compliance rates as well, which is a critical aspect of successful, sustainable health and mental health care. Nurse practitioners tirelessly advocate for those with scarce access to care, the marginalized, the remote, and the rural. We often supervise physician residents in hospitals and other nurse practitioners in the community. We ensure the patient-centered care that creates successful outcomes. Thus, I urge your support for House Bill 3355 and its amendment ensuring psychiatric nurse practitioners can help develop a strong, compassionate, collaborative, and competent workforce that brings all Oregonians what they deserve, effective mental health treatment, all within reach. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Colleagues, any question for this panel? Questions for this panel? Representative Parrish. Oh,
it's not, my constituents might be very happy with me. So my biggest concern on this bill for 7 years, because Kinnemer has had this every year that I've been here, has always been about the pediatric side, and pediatricians in our community have screamed at me over this for a long time, and concerns about just the development of a child at that age and turning over the ability to prescribe to psychologists, psychotropic drugs that are, some of them are pretty powerful. And so I've always said that if this bill didn't have the pediatric side, that I would be a yes. Because I think it's a little different when you're an adult and you go make a decision about your own health care. Thoughts about how to address those concerns, because they're still lingering. I have an inbox full of them this morning again, because right now that's why I can't quite cross that threshold to be a yes.
Co-chairs, Representative Parrish, I actually have thought a lot about that issue myself, and that was part of why I was a significant champion of embedding the need for providers to practice in a medical setting. Currently, we do have psychologists embedded in pediatric settings. We are planning to expand that, and having them as part of that collaborative care team brings the expertise into the room. We operated in that fashion in Central Oregon and had a very robust program with psychologists who, if they could have prescribed, that was the one thing that was missing. When I first got to Providence, I went and toured many of our primary care clinics, and even though we have providers in all these clinics, the number one need they had was prescribers. and that's why Providence backed this bill. I would defer to Dr. Geiger to address specifically the pediatric constraints as well.
I think that that's a good question, Representative Parrish. When you look at treatment, the most important part of treatment is diagnosis. If you don't have the diagnosis right, nothing's going to work. And the treatment in a collaborative setting with medical oversight can be done safely. But I think that when I've seen cases that I've been concerned about or didn't go right, it's because the diagnosis was incorrect to begin with. And so I believe this bill requiring licensed psychologists who would have expertise in children to be able to work in that space. The APA Code of Ethics requires that you have expertise in the space that you're practicing in. Those folks would have, I think, excellent diagnostic skills to make a call about what the diagnosis is and then the treatment to move forward. And, of course, they're working in a continuum. A difficult case can get referred out. Within our system, psychiatry will be supervising the medical practice of all of these psychologists. So there will be oversight. It's not going to be somebody, you know, in an office downtown on the 11th floor. These people will be connected and integrated with the medical system with oversight reporting up in our system to me. So I feel comfortable that this will be safe. And right now what's happening, family practice doctors are winging it. Pediatricians are winging it. That's what we have as current state and will continue to be unless we do something.
Please. So we've had experiences with this with our own children where I would say our pediatrician wasn't winging it, working in concert with a child psychologist who sort of makes that diagnosis and then comes back around. And, you know, and as our children were on other medications that were not related to mental health issues, certainly that's the other piece of that concern for me is sort of the management of other meds that a child might be on. And if I just feel like, and in talking to my own pediatrician, the concern is, you know, is sort of pulling that sort of back out of the purview and not having good dialogue is the concern. And I just trying to still wrap my head around the safety piece for children, just because you see some of the articles and read some of the reactions and things that kids are having on some of these meds. They're strong and they're powerful, and combined with other drugs, combined with things they might get into that we don't know that they're going to get into, I just can't quite wrap my head around this one yet. So I can't answer it still.
Okay. Anyone else for this panel? Thank you all very much. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Next, I'd like to call Dr. Ajit Jetmalani, Dr. David Pollack, and Dr. Jim Lace, I believe.
Madam Co-Chair and members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to testify in front of you. My name is Ajit Jetmalani. I'm a clinical professor of psychiatry, child psychiatry, and head of OHSU's Division of Child Psychiatry. I also serve as a consultant to the Oregon Health Authority and am a past president of the Oregon Council of Child Psychiatry. During my 29 years of practice in Oregon, I participated in the training of over 80 adult psychiatrists. 58 child psychiatrists, and I've reviewed thousands of charts, both in my role as medical director of behavioral health at Providence for 10 years, and Providence Health Plans for 10 years. And in my current role at Oregon Health Authority, where we are overseeing implementation of House Bill 3114 from 2009, which is intended to improve appropriate use of psychotropic medicines in the foster youth population. I understand what it takes to train safe and competent healthcare providers, and I know the pitfalls of poor training and the challenges that we have in delivering mental health care in Oregon. Today I'm representing Oregon Council of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry. I'm concerned that characterization of this discussion as a turf issue closes off ears and minds and hearts, and I'm asking you to be open to data and make an informed decision about how you vote on this bill. In my lengthy written testimony, which I'm not going to read, and my attachments, I've offered 10 key reasons why I believe this bill will fail to safely expand mental health services to our citizens. I've also offered an alternative methodology for a motivated psychologist to achieve prescriptive authority safely. In addition, there are alternative strategies that increase the primary care provider's capacity to treat mental health and behavioral health conditions in the medical home. And we have evidence of the effectiveness of the strategy through both the OPAL-K project, which is consultation to primary care by child psychiatrists across Oregon, and the ECHO project, which is a methodology of training primary care over a year of weekly sessions to improve their capacity to treat mental health in their offices. It's particularly effective and powerful if you have a collaborative care relationship with a psychologist or other type of mental health expert. That's a particularly effective model. I also completely support the extensive amendments that were submitted this morning by Senator Betsy Johnson that I feel would, in fact, make this a safe and effective proposal. But without that, I think this is a very dangerous approach. There are no mental health medications. There are just medications. They affect the body. Please consider that physical health challenges also often mimic or exacerbate mental health challenges. So in that context, consider that providers who complete the current program will not have undergraduate basic science knowledge. They will be in the psychology building. The pre-med students, pre-dental, pre-nursing are in the science building when they're in college. They will not have the same knowledge that other people with prescriptive authority in Oregon have around basic sciences. They will never have evaluated directly, physically, or treated physical health challenges themselves. They will not be able to order or interpret lab tests. They will have very limited, loosely defined training for special populations, as pointed out by Representative Parrish. It's a three-month requirement for an ill-defined specialized training for children to prescribe very powerful drugs to kids. And they will most assuredly, and I can assure you, based on the language of the bill, function in a quasi-independent fashion in many settings in their collaboration agreement with primary care. Providence is a highly sophisticated medical environment, and this training program is based on expecting that the entire process will be managed by a highly sophisticated, well-organized organization. But the people who go through this can practice anywhere, with any collaborative agreement, with any primary care provider, whether they're well-organized or disorganized. I just want to close with one additional comment. In 2009, the legislature rightfully mandated closer oversight for youth in foster care and how medicines are prescribed to them. I have led the effort overseeing that project from 2009. We've worked doggedly over these last 7 years to improve practices for youth who are very vulnerable and at risk. We've dramatically actually reduced the use of psychotropic medicines in that population since 2009, from 19.8% of the population to 9.8% of the population. There are a wide range of practices that were utilized to achieve those outcomes. What we discovered through a multidisciplinary task force and over time is that youth who are traumatized need psychotherapy and psychosocial strategies to support them. We need more psychotherapy in the community, and psychologists are the ideal providers who could deliver that. They're not flocking to Medicaid settings. They're not flocking to the rural environment because we do not have appropriate reimbursement strategies to incentivize people to do so. So please, whatever you decide to do, please do not allow this bill to allow prescriptive authority for people under 18, and please do not allow this to occur for those individuals over 65 who have very complex health conditions interacting with their psychiatric conditions. All of you have a desire to improve access, which I completely share, and you have a duty to protect the public. I'm asking you to exercise your awesome responsibility regarding the latter from a well-informed, apolitical position. Thank you very much for this opportunity to testify.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and Senator, Co-Chair, and members of the committee, my name is David Pollack. I'm a professor for public policy at Oregon Health and Science University. I'm in the psychiatry department, and I teach in the undergraduate medical school. I'm in the Division of Management, where we have a health management MBA program, and in the School of Public Health and Family Medicine as well. So I have multiple appointments. I also was the medical director for the state Addictions and Mental Health Division from 2002 to 2006. And am the last psychiatrist to serve in that role, adult psychiatrist. Dr. Jet Malani has been the only other psychiatrist consulting over this interim since then. That's an unfilled position. The other positions, and I'm saying my bona fides for a particular reason, I'm on the committee of the Health Evidence Review Commission, the Values-Based Benefits Subcommittee that manages the prioritized list for the health plan. I've been on it since it began, so I'm kind of the Lou Gehrig of that committee. But I'm also the chair of the state's Healthcare Workforce Committee for the Health Policy Board. And in relation to that, I want to mention that that committee, which has been in existence since 2009, I was one of the original members, we get charged by the Health Policy Board to look at how many healthcare workers are there, how many should we have over the next 10 years, like a moving window. And particularly, we were charged over the last 2 years, and will continue with our new charter, to look at the issue of integration of behavioral health and primary care. And what are the needs? And we have made a report. We've focused on that. And we have several suggestions. And I'm speaking today, though, as a representative of the Oregon Psychiatric Physicians Association. But you need to know where I'm coming from in terms of the legitimacy of what I'm saying. I certainly respect my colleagues who were here before. Dr. Jet Malani and I helped to train Dr. Geiger, and we have a lot of respect for him, and I've worked a lot with Robin Henderson over the years. We, in this healthcare workforce committee, in reviewing what we should be doing, the issue of psychologist prescribing never arose to the level of a legitimate or a relevant strategy for us to use for a variety of reasons. We have endorsed and are in the process of endorsing other approaches, one of which was included in the written testimony I've given you, and that is the creation of a postgraduate psychiatry fellowship for physician assistants. And we're ready to do that. It would fit nicely. It wouldn't be very expensive in terms of the fact that they could be participating in the same training that our psychiatry residents get in their first year of training. We also have, as Dr. Jet Malani mentioned, the ECHO Project, the Opal K. We have been for several years trying to get an expansion of Opal K to be an Opal A for adults, which is basically a psychiatric consultation resource for any provider in the state to call to get consultation, curbside-type consultations on patients who have psychiatric problems. We also have, as another issue that has prevented access up until now, at the federal level, a set of CPT codes. These are the codes that people use for billing for encounters. There has never been a code that would, in effect, pay for a psychiatric consultant to work with a primary care clinic in these collaborative care models. Now there's a set of codes that are being introduced this year that CMS has approved. These are important factors. We are also gearing up our residency training program at OHSU to help our psychiatry residents as they finish to be more geared to doing consultation in primary care settings, in general medical settings. The Healthcare Workforce Committee has also made recommendations, and we're pursuing with the GME consortium that we created a set of residency slots outside of the OHSU, outside the metropolitan area, in family medicine, general internal medicine, and general psychiatry to try to address this access issue. These and other efforts, I think, will help to increase access. That, coupled with the fact that in the states where psychologist prescribing has been passed, there has not been the movement of psychologists to low access areas, as has been claimed. I want to just say a couple other things.
Okay, and Dr. Pollack, I'm sorry, could you wrap yourself up in about a minute? Because I do want to finish here. Yeah.
I'm going to stop with one thing. Okay. It was mentioned that there was this consortium, a work group back after the 2009-2010 session, there was consensus about this. Dr. George Keepers, who's the chair of the OHSU Department of Psychiatry, just sent me a message. He and Dr. Knight Richardson were on that commission. He says, Dr. Knight Richardson and I worked in good faith with the legislatively established task force on psychology prescribing. However, neither of us agreed with the proposal that came from that task force. It was, in our view, flawed in many respects and would have established an inadequate and dangerous to the public program. In addition, both of us were very troubled by the inclusion in that group of an individual who had serious conflict of interest. That person who ran a psychology school in California was not a citizen of Oregon and would have profited personally from the passage of that bill. I just wanted to set the record straight on that. I think the last thing I would say is that Jürgen Unitzer, who's the chair of the psychiatry department at the University of Washington, which is where this collaborative care model originated, has been thoroughly researched. Their model does, he's written articles about, quote, all hands on deck, which is a phrase that Robin used a little while ago. And he fully endorses the idea of psychologists being involved. But as Dr. Jet Malani was saying, in the proper roles, in the role of providing testing and providing psychotherapy and consultation, health psychologists are very important and are a big part of the team that would be working, just not as prescribing providers. We think there's another pool of people that we think could be easily used to increase the access to medically trained prescribing psychiatric providers. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
I forgot to mention, I'm also one of Representative Parrish's constituents.
Okay. Thank you. Dr. Lace.
Good morning, Chairman Roach, Chair Smith-Warner, and members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to testify. I am the legislative chairperson for the Oregon Medical Association. I also am a pediatrician here in Salem, Oregon, and have been here for 40 years. So I have a lot of experience in pediatric issues. And the whole idea of having a separate group of prescribing people, you know, psychologists that are being trained to provide medications, you know, is very questionable to me and raises potential issues. In our clinic, we serve, each month varies a little bit, but somewhere between 60 to 70% Medicaid population, extremely high-risk kids, foster kids, kids that are in and out of different situations, traumatized kids. We heard all these other diagnoses out there. Those are the kids that we see every day in our office. We have two full-time psychologists in our office. We're open 6 days a week with a psychologist there. We have a psychologist teaching program within our office. And we also employ a pediatric nurse practitioner, mental health prescriber, for backup if we have questions about medications. So we, I think, are doing this vision that I hear, this collaboration model, you know, where you're going to have these people embedded together where mental health and physical health, if you want to call that separation there, we're actually doing that now. And it works. And so we have these kids that come in. If they're suicidal that day, we stop. And we make arrangements, and we can continue on instead of saying, "Oh, you need to go down to the health department down the street or something like that." So we are doing that, but our psychologists that are in our office do not prescribe. If they need somebody to do the prescribing for a medication, we're there, we're available. We have a lot of background in medications, you know, psychotropic drugs. There's a lot of side effects with these drugs, especially in kids. So many of these kids come on drugs, they're off of these medications, and this whole thing about foster care and over-prescribing these things, we'll get these kids from these group homes that are on 6 or 7 medications, like what? And what were people thinking? And so we kind of get that all pared down. A lot of them can come off once they're in a stable social situation. So we're doing that model, but this doesn't address one of our concerns, which is, you know, 3 months extra training in pediatric psychotropic prescribing. It's a very high-risk population. We go through medical school. We have undergraduates. We go through 4 years of medical school, 3 years of residency program in pediatrics, and then we have continuing medical education requirements after that, and the list goes on. But we are doing this collaboration model, and this bill does not help that high-risk population here. You know, we are addressing that. So outside of this community, I don't know what they would be doing, you know, in other settings, and will they actually do that? One of the big issues that's pointed out, there's not adequate funding. We are continually going back and forth with Marion County in terms of trying to get mental health money and how that's appropriated, and it's a continuing battle, I can tell you that. It's not a simple project where everybody says, oh, let's sit down and spend the money properly for kids and blah, blah, blah. That doesn't happen that way. It's a continual, there's tensions all the time. So we don't think this bill is necessary. necessary. And as it is, and with the amendments, which I have not seen, but with the training from certain people, find what we need are people that will actually sit down and talk with these families, with these kids. That's what we don't have enough of. And in our office, we have that now. And so it really is a good model, but they're not out writing prescriptions. They're out talking to these families, giving them other alternatives to dealing with all these other, you know, social stressors. So I'll stop there. Answer
Thank
any
you.
Questions.
Any questions for this panel, colleagues? Thank you very much for your testimony. So I have two people still signed up, but I'd really like to ask if they only come up if they have additional things to add that they don't believe have been brought out yet. That's Jen Baker from ONA and Dr. Peter Grover from Pacific University.
Chair Smith Warner and Monroe, members of the committee, Jen Baker on behalf of the Oregon Nurses Association and Nurse Practitioners of Oregon. The only thing that I will add is that the inclusion of psychiatric mental health nurse practitioners is not in the current version of the bill. That is in the -13 amendment. So I would urge your support of that amendment. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, Peter Grover. I'm an assistant professor of psychology at Pacific University. I also am the behavioral science faculty for the family medicine residency program at Providence Milwaukee Hospital. So I train family medicine physicians in the human side of what they do. And I've watched the growth of the integration of psychology in primary care over the years. I mostly want to be available to answer any questions you have. The big thing that I will say about some of the concerns that have been raised is, one, psychologists have been doing this in various ways for a number of years. If there were actual incidents or data regarding safety, I'm certain opposition would have brought them that up. You've heard none. So although there are concerns, that I haven't seen any specific information that backs up those concerns. The other big thing I'll say is an integral part of any professional's training is what I call knowing what you know and knowing what you don't know. Psychologists who get this training to prescribe are very keen on what they don't know. We're ready and willing to hand off, pass along, and refer people to a specialist who has the body of knowledge that we don't whenever that's needed. And so I feel like this fills a nice gap in the middle between what regular physicians offer and our specialist colleagues in psychiatry offer that can provide a great service. And I'll answer any questions if you have.
Thank you. Colleagues, any questions? Okay. With
thank
that,
so
I'm going to thank you. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3355 and open a work session on House Bill 3355.
Okay. Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, members of the committee, as you've heard, House Bill 3335 comes to you from the House Committee on Healthcare, where it received three separate hearings. The bill authorizes the Board of Psychologist Examiners to issue either a full or conditional certificate authorizing a licensed psychologist with certain experience and education to prescribe drugs, excluding opiate-based narcotics, that are used in mental health treatment. A certificate of prescriptive authority must be renewed every 2 years. Psychologists holding a conditional certificate of prescribing authority may only prescribe a drug if a licensed prescribing physician approves the prescription in writing. The bill also establishes a 9-member committee on prescribing psychologists within the Board of Psychologist Examiners to advise the board. Passage of this bill is anticipated to have a fiscal impact on the Board of Psychologist Examiners. The board is required to provide staffing support to the committee on prescribing psychologists, including reimbursing committee members for expenses. The board will also be responsible for issuing certificates as well as enforcing compliance and addressing complaints. The startup cost for the program is estimated at $55,762 other funds because the board is allowed to assess fees to recoup costs. This amount will cover one limited duration position at a 2.5 FTE. This amount includes personal services for an operations and policy analyst position for 6 months to work with existing staff to develop the certificate program, including drafting rules, creating forms, and establishing the process. The board also requested additional services and supplies for a permanent half-time administrative one position for ongoing staff support. However, LFO recommends that the board return to the legislature once recommendation for the formulary, the education standards are adopted, and the fee schedule is established, and when the program parameters are more defined with a more accurate request for additional resources.
Senator Monroe, we have some amendments? Oh, sorry.
Yes.
You start with that, Kim.
Yeah. We have
four amendments. We'll start with the -A10 amendment specifies that the committee must meet at least once each quarter unless there's no business to conduct. It allows the Board of Psychologists examiners to consult and disclose investigatory information with the Committee on Prescribing Psychologists, and it also clarifies that a residency doesn't have to be in the state. It can be in another state. And okay. That's the -10.
Madam Co-Chair, I move the -10 amendment to House Bill 3355.
Senator Monroe has moved the -A10 amendment to House Bill 3355. Discussion? Any objection?
Which?
I'm sorry, the -A10, Representative. There will be four total.
I'll have those in Ellis.
Oh, they're there.
They should be there.
Yeah, I was going to say, I read them at the beginning of the committee.
I have the wrong bill, I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Do you want to reserve your right to object?
No, ma'am.
Without objection, so moved.
Okay, next you have the -A11 amendment. The -A11 amendment removes the United States Department of Defense Psychopharmacology Demonstration Project as one of the qualifiers for applying for conditional certificate of prescriptive authority.
Madam Co-Chair, I move the -11 amendment to 3355.
Senator Monroe has moved the -A11 amendment to House Bill 3355. Any discussion? Any objection? One objection, Representative Parrish. So moved.
And the next amendment you have is the -A13. The -A13 adds prescribing nurse practitioners to list the professionals along with prescribing physicians who can approve prescriptions and enter into collaborative agreements with psychologists seeking prescriptive authority. It also replaces the pharmacist member of the committee with the prescribing nurse practitioner.
Madam Co-Chair, I move the -13 amendment to House Bill 3355.
Senator Monroe has moved the -A13 to House Bill 3355. Any discussion? Any objection? Representative Parrish objects. With that, so moved.
And the last amendment is the -16. This simply adds the $55,762 other funds limitation for the Board of Psychologists Examiners to fund startup costs for the program.
Madam Co-Chair, I move the -16 amendment to House Bill 3355.
Senator Monroe has moved the -A16 amendment to House Bill 3355. Any discussion? Any objection? Representative Parrish? So moved.
Okay, and LFO recommends that House Bill 3355, as amended by the -A10, the -A11, the -A13, and the -A16 amendments, be moved to the Ways and Means Full Committee.
Madam Co-Chair, I move House Bill 3355, as amended by the 10, 11, 13, and 16 amendments, to the full Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Monroe has moved House Bill 3355 as amended with the A10, A11, A13, and A16 to the full Committee on Ways and Means. With recommendation?
Yes.
With recommendation.
Favorable recommendation.
With favorable recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Representative Parrish and Senator Thompson. So noted, and with that, the motion passes.
Madam Co-Chair, we need carrier to the full, and we need carrier to the House and the Senate.
Okay. Let's see who's on the full. I'll carry to the full.
Okay.
And I can't carry to the Senate, though.
No, I'll do the Senate.
Okay, Senator Monroe to the Senate, and Representative Kennemer will carry to the floor. Good. To the House, sorry.
That's good.
Okay. With that, I will close the work session on House Bill 3355. And if we have no other business, colleagues, I will close today's meeting. And we will keep you posted on our next meeting date, but we know it won't be tomorrow.